So, welcome everyone to today's lecture in virtual machines. Welcome back, the remaining few of you. And now, let's maybe recap a little bit about what we have established for last time. So, the idea was to come up with an instruction set and a few data structures to implement a virtual machine, which consists of said instruction set together with its semantics with respect to what the runtime engine should do with the data structures that we specified to support the execution of the instruction set. So we came up with a few basic structures like the stack for the general data, the code store for storing the instruction, and a few registers, mainly the program counter and the instruction register, and the what else was there, the stack pointer, I think. So these are the basic data structures that we have so far. We have started to specify the semantics of a few instructions in the form of giving the actual syntax of the instruction together with a diagram of the machine state before and after the execution of said instruction. And in most of the cases, I think we have also given kind of pseudocode of what the runtime the runtime system should actually do to the underlying data structures. So far, we have covered the instructions that deal with evaluation of the of expressions mainly, and then we have covered the basic arithmetic operations, the evaluation of the conditionals, and we have even tackled expressions with variables, which would be a little bit more difficult than generic, more difficult than all the other expressions we had so far, since there's different notions of how to treat variables when we evaluate expressions due to the nature of a variable having properties like a value and an address. And in certain contexts, we need either the address of a variable or the value of a variable. That was the state of the art for last lecture, I guess. And as a kind of a general thing for the instructions in a stack machine, we had that there is the operands already prepared on top of the stack or on the top few cells of the stack, and the instruction would leave its result, if there is any, as the new top of stack while consuming the operands. So, that is the state of the art of last time. Let's continue on with the instruction sets for the C machine. So far we have had the expression evaluation, and we have had a lot of particular expression sub-expressions already. So it's not far from the state that we have been in last time to come to actual statements. So in programming language terms, a statement is kind of can be an expression that is closed and is not and the value is not further used anymore. It kind of terminates a particular evaluation of a more complicated expression. Can do so. So we can find as legal C code expressions followed by a semicolon usually. So that is usually the case when you have basic assignments in your program code. You usually put up an assignment expression first, like x plus y plus 1 and plus 1, like this. And the if it stays like this, it is an expression. You can make it into an actual statement by adding a semicolon to the end. And now the temporary value computed through the evaluation of that expression is at the end discarded, so we can clear the stack from any intermediate computations, and the remaining effect of the remaining effect on the state of the machine of such a thing is then just the side effect that happened during the evaluation of the expression. Just put it back from there. What is the side effect of such a thing? Well, you remember that during the evaluation of the assignment expression, we had this left-hand side for which we had to compute the address, because on an assignment expression we would store the computed value for the right-hand side into the address or the slot that is associated with the address of the left-hand side. And that is, in that sense, a side effect of the evaluation of that thing. And that would be the only thing that survives the execution of that statement. So that is the kind of connection between expressions and expression statements in that sense. So now, for our purposes of translating such a thing, we are given the subconstruct of a statement in the form of the actual expression and the terminating semicolon. We have to come up with code for that. During the evaluation of statements, there is no need to fork between left-hand side value and right-hand side values, so we find ourselves within just without any particular context, so we can define just the plain code generation function code, and it's given as parameter said tuple of the expression and the semicolon, and the translation scheme for that is to, well, first of all, evaluate the expression with this code R, R for R values, so it's about the actual computing actual value of E with the row that is given from the, well, surroundings. And we have just talked about this notion of expression evaluation always keeping the current value of an expression on the stack. Well, in the end, when we turn over to generating statements, we don't need this intermediate value anymore. So what we usually would like to do is to clear that from the stack, and that's what we can do with just a simple pop. And, well, you usually know these things from data structures or production to technical informatics or something like that. Pop is just, well, takes stack and removes the topmost cell, and that is easily done in our runtime engine by just decrementing the stack pointer. So this turns expressions into statements. And maybe another thing that we would like to do at that point is to extend the language that we generate code for to a sequence of statements. That's what we usually find within bodies of functions. And for that, we need a code generation defined for such sequences of statements, which is usually a list of statements. And in this functional kind of matching way, we can access the first element and the list of the following elements with this pattern over here, this S and SS, with S being the single statement and SS being the list of statements. And this would just be translated by code for the actual first statement, followed by code for the list of the following statements, and the whole thing's terminated with the empty list, which just does not provide any instructions. So we just concatenate each of the statements instructions in order to obtain the instructions of a sequence of statements. So maybe let's switch over to something a little bit more intriguing than just sequences of instructions, which would be instructions that manipulate the control flow. And for that we have the concepts of conditionals and or conditional and iterative statements. So what would that what would be the basic mechanism that we introduce for that? That would be the a concept for modifying the continuation of our program execution. And well, if you think back of how we have implemented the way that instructions find their next instruction, was that by default the interpretation loop that is run by the runtime system would obtain a new instruction and at the same time generate the address of the following instruction and store it in the program counter, and then only would start to interpret the actual next instruction. So this gives us the chance to override the default target with which the interpretation loop would continue to retrieve new instructions into the memory by overriding the program counter. We don't have an actual way of really accessing the internal variables of the virtual machine from the instruction set itself, but what we can do is give kind of a higher level interface to this these internal registers with instructions like the one that you see over here, which is this jump A thing. And what that does is it leaves the stack completely alone, but what it does is it modifies the program counter in a particular way, and what it does is it stores a particular address into the program counter. So the implementation of the whole thing is just, well, assigning some address to the program counter. So that is kind of a basic idea. When you have when you modify the program counter as an effect of an instruction, and the next run through the interpretation loop, we will not go to the directly following instruction, but to the address of A and retrieve the instruction from there. So since it's not particularly different from just linear lists, we might be interested in not a static jump, but a conditional jump, depending on the evaluation of certain runtime values. And for that, we complicate this control flow deviation a little bit with a few new instructions, or, well, at least one, which is, in this case, this jump 0, A. And, well, what does that actually do? This now may write to the program counter. You see that here. And it may assign the address A to the program counter depending on a few preconditions, namely the actual content of the top of the stack. So in case that the top of the stack is 0, then the jump 0 will move the address that is given as parameter into the program counter. In case that we found something different from 0 on top of the stack, then we leave the program counter alone, and in all of the cases the top of the stack will be consumed, so thrown away in that sense. In terms of pseudocode to be integrated into the virtual machine runtime, what we would do is, in case that the top of the stack is 0, then the program count is modified, and in each case, the stack pointer is just decremented. So that is the semantics of the jump 0. So these are kind of the tools that we're going to use in the next few slides in order to implement these control flow altering statements. Maybe a few remarks to the this A that we have had on the slide so far. So I just called them addresses for in order to keep the slides somewhat clean and the examples understandable. We use here symbolic jump targets. So this A here is to be, well, in concrete machines, this would probably be some kind of numeric value. We just replace them with easy to read names like A, B, C, D, or something like that. And they would be later somewhere in our pipeline would be replaced with actual absolute addresses, for example. You could also choose to generate something like relative addresses, depending on whatever needs you have. If you, for example, are interested in code that is not actually always at the same absolute address in memory, you might want to generate relative addresses to some well-known things like the program counter or something like that.
Isn't this generating of these addresses then something the assembler usually does?
Well, usually. Frequently, yes.
The assembler may also need to actually reorder things in case there are things that can't jump that far, for example.
There might be need for that, yes. So,
I personally think it may be a bit wasteful doing that already and then doing it again.
So, symbolic. I think there's a lot of use for these kind of symbolic things out there, particularly also if you do things like modules where you where you don't know where in your process memory you actually will find your piece of code later on, and if you just compose it with other ones, you might want to have these kind of symbolic addresses anyway. So yeah, there's a lot of use for that. So I think it's not a bad abstraction that we have here. There's use for that. So, what can we do with such instructions now? So, we have already started with particular statements, the statement sequences and the expression statements. Now, let's have a look at the so-called conditional statement, or statements, because there's several notions of that. And the typical way how you find them present in your input, in your syntax tree, is some designation that this is the conditional statement, particularly introduced with an if in that case. There's an actual condition, and there is a statement that is meant to be executed in case that the expression evaluates in a certain pattern. So, in a certain way. So, what we need to do now conceptually is that we need to somehow evaluate the conditional expression. This is the first thing that we do. Then we need to check whether the expression has evaluated to something like true. So true is different to zero. So this would be a thing that we would like to separate from the case where this evaluates to zero. So this jump zero would be a good instruction to use here. This indicates exactly these two cases. And, well, in case that the expression has evaluated to true, it is non-zero, thus it will we would not want to deviate from the standard fall-through. Instead, the execution would just continue with the next statement that follows behind the jump zero, and in case that the expression has evaluated to false, then we would continue after the code for the true case. And in order to do so, of course, we need to have this jump zero instruction in the middle. We prepend the evaluation of the expression, thus code R for E. And then directly after the jump Z for the fall through, we include the code generation for the true case statement. And then finally, we need to designate where the false case should actually continue and where the executed true case falls through, and this is done by just putting this symbolic label A in there. And of course, when you do code generation, you might have several might find several instances of conditional statements throughout your code, so you're not supposed to put the same symbolic label in each occurrence of a conditional statement, but you would have to somehow manage which labels you have already burned earlier on and use a fresh label there. So this A here is supposed to be a fresh label, but within this particular pattern, whenever I repeat an A, I mean the actual same label. So this is important later on, where we have patterns with several labels where they are fresh for that particular sub-expression, but within the sub-expression, they are actually meant to be reused. Okay, so this is the simple conditional statement. Of course, there's also the idea of the more complex one, where we now extend the simple one with an else clause, introducing a case that is, or a statement that is reachable for the false case. And well, what we have had before is the evaluation of the actual conditional expression that remains the same. We have had the branch between the true and the false case with a jump Z. We have had the true case with the code generation for the S, and we had the actual target for the false branch, like here. So now, in order to extend a particular code extend the example by a particular code sequence for the false branch, which is meant to not be reachable in the true case, what we need to do as well, the false case starts over here. So this is probably the place for the false statement. However, we need to make sure that the true branch does not actually reach that thing. So we need to jump over that thing in case that we came through the true statement. And that is achieved by this combination over here. We simply, at the end of the true statement, we append a jump B unconditionally, because we already know that the expression had been evaluated to true. So we can add the jump without a zero. We introduce a new label B, which is different to the label A and different to every other label before. And this will be the new continuation point for, well, after the complete statement is executed. And, well, the false statement will directly fall through to that anyway, so we don't need any jumps over here. And yeah, with that, we are done. So just add a jump and another label, and you're good. Let's have an example for that. There's the address environment row containing addresses for X and Y, 4 and 7. and our example statement, so the one over here, with comparison in the conditional expression, and two assignment statements in the true and the false branch. In order to make it more transparent to you what the translation actually is, there is also labels for the different parts of the source code so that we can actually realize what the low-level code is. So let's have a look at the low-level code. First of all, let's start with the conditional, because the pattern for translating the conditional statement says so. So we have to first descend into the conditional expression. The conditional expression is then evaluated for its R value, so the code R for the, this thing, and this will essentially do depth first search through this thing in post order, and will first of all meet this X. X is a variable, so we will use our new fancy macro load A for load address of this X thing. We have to look up the value of X in there, which is 4, so this will leave us with a load A of 4. Then the depth first search will hit the Y, which will also be, which we also treat as variable, thus we load it since we are in R value mode. So we load address 7. Then the first search post order will hit the comparator, the greater one. So we emit the operator for that as an instruction. And this is then already the evaluation, or giving us the value of the conditional expression on top of the stack. So now, based on that thing, we can perform the first or this disambiguation between the two cases by checking for whether it is 0 or something else. And this is achieved with a jump. This belongs to the if. So jump 0 disambiguates between true and false. It falls through in case of something not 0, so the true case. This will be this one over here. So this one. And for that guy, we have the code generation for an expression statement, which is essentially consists in the code R, so the evaluation of the underlying expression, and a following pop. So the pop we can already place there, and then we need to provide the R value code generation for the assignment expression, which consists in the code R for the right hand side and the code L for the left hand side, together with a store of the at that thing. So let's have a look at that. We will descend into this sub expression over here, hit variable X, creating a load A of X, which is 4. The first search reaches Y then, which will be load A 7. Then we hit the next one, which is a subtraction. So we come to sub. Then the code generation for the assignment expression says that we have to do the store instruction at the address 4. So we obtain this address out of the address environment and store it like this. And then, we're done with the evaluation scheme for this assignment expression. And what else is there? In terms of general context of where we are, we have now created the code of the true statement, and now have to make sure to reach the actual end of the conditional statement. So therefore, we have a jump B. This still belongs to this if-else construct over here. So this jump B will make sure that after the execution of the true statement, we actually reach the outside world of the conditional statement, which we find over here. This is the continuation address. So we jump to that particular thing. Now we still need to provide what the code for the zero case of the conditional is. And that was the case where we jumped to A. So this is where we place the A label. And then we work our way through the statement over here, which will be this one over here. And it's again an expression statement, so we need a pop of the intermediate value, and then perform similar steps as we had for the case before, just with other addresses for the variables, and this will lead into in these things over here, pretty analogous to the ones from before. So that's the way that we can do simple conditional branching. Good? Yeah? And we will fall through to the execution of the false branch from the true branch. And there is behavior in C-like languages that has this kind of fall through, optional fall through in the switch cases, for example. So there you have to manually set this X thing with a break instruction. And so that is kind of the behavior that you can expect. You can fall from one case into the other if you forget to place the break. Of course, here, if you incorporate this jump B into your translation scheme, you will never forget that anyway, because it's baked into the whole translation. But in the switch statements, you have the control over that behavior. Okay. Good, so let's go on with the next control flow modifying construct, which is the while loop. So for that one, we have a statement of the flowing form. We have while, marking the whole thing as the while statement. We have, again, a conditional expression and a statement to be executed repeatedly as long as a re-evaluation of the same expression remains true. So, let's have a look at what we would like to do there. So, if you just start with this whole while loop thingy, the first thing that we need to do is to check whether we actually have to execute the body at least once. And for that, we need to somehow look at the evaluation of the expression. So that is what we do at first. We start, just ignore the labels for now. We just start with the evaluation of the conditional expression, just like we did in the if case. And again, just like we did in the if statement, we jump to some other place in case we the conditional expression evaluates to false, so to zero, we jump somewhere else, which for our cases would be somewhere outside of the loop, because we need to continue after the loop in case that the condition has never been true at all. In case it has been true, then of course we need to take care of executing the body. So that is where we place the code generation for the body. And the question is now: what do we do after we have executed the body at least once? Well, in that case, it is a little bit different to the conditional branch, because we then need to make sure that we again iterate through the whole thing, so we jump back to the beginning. So this is kind of the new part compared to the conditional statement. We just jump back to the start of the whole thing, so we introduce another set of labels, which is used for back jumping. And that is the thing. So far, it's not so radically different from the conditional statement that we have to talk in depth about that, I think. So we can focus on an example. So let's have a look at this thing over here. We have an address environment. Again. Address environment like this, with 7, 8, and 9 for A, B, and C. And the actual statement to translate, a while statement. So for that, we know that, first of all, we need the back jump address. So that's what we add here. And in the end, we will have a jump back. So this is also added here. We will have an address outside of the loop over here, and we will have a part that deals with the conditional expression. We will have a part that deals with the statement sequence from in there, which is this one here, and we will have still a facility coming from the while code pattern, which is this jump B. So first of all, we have the back jump address. We have the evaluation of this red box, which is the conditional expression. This will evaluate this will generate code to just this load address for A, which is 7. Then load a constant for the compared number here, 0, and then do a greater than comparison operator, and this already leaves us with the deciding number on top of the stack, so we can directly go to the jump Z for disambiguating between the two cases. In case that we need to execute the main loop, we will continue with this blue thing, which is just two assignment expression statements, and this will lead to the blue box over here, which does pretty similar things as we had already on the slides before. So it's just a binary expression and an assignment with load A's and load C's together with the binary operator and an according store to a variable, followed by a pop, since both of these things are statements and need to get rid of the intermediate value. So that's that. And just in the end of the whole thing, the execution will fall into an unconditional jump, because we need to reevaluate the condition in order to decide whether we have to repeat or not. And for that, we jump back to the beginning, where we find the conditional expression evaluated, and in that case, continue with a loop. Only in the case that the reevaluation fails with a zero on top of the stack, we will then jump out of the loop. So that's your while loop there. So with that, we have already quite mighty tools. So let's extend that with syntactic sugar. There's this idea of a for loop that is existing for C code. So for loops essentially consist in, of course, the keyword, but also a statement for the loop body as we had it before in the while loop, but the brackets are now extended by a few other things. So this is a triple over here, and these for loops can somewhat be, or well, could be in a simple case be translated into constructs that we already have, so the kind of a high level translation could be there and would look like this pattern over here. So the first part of the tuple, this E1, would be considered as a statement that goes to the very start of the thing, usually used to initialize some kind of counter variable in these for loops. Then the actual condition for when the loop should be evaluated, and then another statement which is meant to be executed just before the loop evaluation is restarted, and this can be achieved by appending that to the usual loop body. So if we take it like that, then we can just reuse the code generation pattern from the while loop, and this will look like the following case. So first of all, we need to provide the code for the initial statement, which is just code R for E1 and pop. Then we have the actual loop. So there is a backjump label over here. We have the jump to the outside of the loop and the actual backjump from over here. We do the evaluation of the conditional expression over here. We have the code generation for the main loop body over here, and then we add the code generation for the increment statement, like this. Statements also need a pop after the code R thing, so that's what usually is done. So please note that this is kind of a simplified reusage pattern in that sense. This usually works as long as you keep your subset of your language free of continuous statements. These mess around a little bit with the control flow within the body. This is nothing that can't be repaired. You can rearrange the code generation in a way that they are compatible with continuous statements, but for purposes of being concise here on the slides, I don't do that. But I think there might be some kind of exercise on the tutorial sheet or something where you incorporate these continuous statements into translation schemes at some point. So for that, you would have to somehow rearrange a little bit the already existing code generation scheme for loops and add new things for continuous statements. So I'll let you tinker with that in the tutorial, I think. So let's move on to, I think it's the last of the control flow or intra-procedural control flow manipulation statements, which will be the switch statement. So switch, as you all know, is this switch based on the evaluation of a particular expression, and it offers several alternatives where to jump to depending on the actual value of the switch expression and also a default value. And the dream would be to, well, of course we could do something like syntactic rewrite of the switch statement into a chain of if-then-else statements where we would check for the actual value of the switch expression in each of the conditionals of the if-then-else. However, that is kind of a messy thing, creates a lot of boilerplate code, and also leads to, well, kind of a execution time that depends on the number of cases that you offer there in the worst case, and that is something that you might want to circumvent. So there is the idea of trying to approximate constant time execution for multi-target branching. And the idea would be to move away from these chains of if then else clauses to, well, essentially an indexed jump through a jump table. So this is a trick that you might have seen several times already in your career here, and particularly in compiler construction. It happens a lot. For example, if you try to implement final automata, for example, then you would also come up with the idea of having jump tables for the for state transitions. So that is a usual pattern that is used here. So, of course, if you want to base your implementation for switch statements on these jump tables, you need some way of performing indexed jumps. So that is a thing that we need to somehow provide in our runtime environment. So for that, we introduce a new instruction, which is this jumpy B, which is considered to be such to implement such behavior, particularly indexed jumps. So, as semantics, what does it do? JumpyB will start from a situation where the top of stack contains a number, and what it will do is it will consume the top of the stack and jump to a particular address by rewriting the content of the program counter with the sum of the base address that it has been given as a parameter and the value that it finds on top of the stack. So that is what is also implemented in the pseudocode over there. The PC is rewritten by B plus top of the stack, with the stack being decremented in the next part. So that's our kind of tool for implementing this jump table. So let's have a look what that means for code generation. So switch statements, for our purposes right here, are ones that look like the following. They consist in a switch keyword followed by the actual expression on which to dispatch. And we emanate from forms where we have cases that run from 0 to a particular k-1 without any holes. And each of the cases has its own statement, which could be a sequence of statements, of course. That's also a statement, but for purposes of grammar, this is just a statement. And each of these things comes with a break statement. So for our purposes, we don't have this fall-through behavior, but instead, we always jump to the end of the switch. And there's the default case, which will have its own statement. So, as the pattern for translating for that would be the following. So, of course, you can imagine that we need to somehow start with evaluating the actual expression based on which we want to dispatch. So, this is achieved by code R of E. And then what we want to have, of course, is some places where we generate code for each of the statements. So these places over here. So we have k many cases, with default being the kth case. And each of them are supposed to, at some point, exit the switch statement. So we put a jump d at the end of each of these things, together with a d, which is the exit point of the switch statement. Now the question is only, how do we now realize the actual dispatching from one case to another? And for that, the idea is to... we said we would like to have something like a jump table. So the idea is to store that in form of consecutive instructions, each of them jumping to the according labels of statements that are associated with each of the cases. So for case 0, we jump to label C0. For default case, we jump to the clause for the to the case for the default case, and so on. And note that in our code store, we have a cell for each of the instructions in there. So each of these jump instructions are located with a next to each other in memory, and are addressed also next to each other. All of them are addressed based on an address which we can give a symbolic name via this label B over here. So these jumps here are now somehow reachable via an indexed jump based on this label B. Okay? And so now everything that we need to add to the whole thing is an actual indexed jump. We will do so, but we will do so also in a little bit of a obfuscated way within this check macro over here, which we haven't talked about so far. So this is the macro that will internally do this indexed jump, but also a little bit more. Particularly, what we need to make sure is that we get the semantics of the jump to the default case right. For these, we need to make sure that everything that is out of the bounds of the cases from 0 to k minus 1 will dispatch to k. So there's actually a little bit of work to do, and this is covered by this check macro, which has three parameters. It has the 0, k, and b. And what it will actually do is it will perform the checks, so comparisons with 0 and k, with this load c of the constants that it is given over here, and will do once greater or equal or less jump, less comparison, and in both cases that these things are false, it will jump to a particular case A, which is the one that catches everything that is out of our bounds. So this is the case that we see over here, where we will pop the actual value of the thing and dispatch to K by rewriting the top of the stack with just K, and then perform an this jump B, which is jumpy B, which is this indexed jump to B with offset given by K. And in case that none of the bounds checks have been violated, we already have a valid index on the stack, so we can just continue with an ordinary indexed jump to B. So you see that so far I've marked a lot of things, but not these two buggers over here, which are new instructions that we need for the implementation of that particular macro. These are, this dup thing is there to actually duplicate the top of the stack, because for our purposes we want to compute with the top of the stack without actually destroying or consuming the content, because we need to reuse it later on, particularly in case of the both of these comparisons need to not touch the original value, because it is used later on with this jump I. So we are in need of a new instruction dupe, and this does a duplication, which is quite easily implemented. So this is this dupe thing over here, emanating from a stack with a value on top, and leaving the stack with one more cell containing a duplicate of the original. And I think the implementation is quite straightforward. Okay. So, this is, of course, kind of a lengthy thing, but this implements the semantics of the constant time dispatching of the switch statement. There are a few remarks, maybe. For example, considering this macro check, there are languages for which there are concepts of trying to certify that the value coming from the conditional expression, for example, will never violate the boundaries of switch statement. For these, for example, you could just remove the boundary checks and do a straightforward jump indexed, and don't care about these boundary checks. But this is just, well, this depends on how intelligent your compiler is, and how, particularly how mighty your semantic analysis is, your value range analysis of the conditional expression is the one that is important here, and there might be cases where you just can't certify that your boundaries will never be violated, either because they are, or because it is too difficult to certify. So there might be C-like languages where there are sometimes bounds checks and sometimes not. What else is there to say? Of course, yeah, for the pattern that we have here, we emanate from the case that there are actually the cases that start from zero and reach a particular K and don't have any holes in there. This might be a little bit too much for practical purposes. You could find an easy modification for the case where the first case starts with some number. You can just replace the zero in the implementation with the actual number where the case starts, of course. But still, there is the constraint that there need to be no holes in your cases. And this leads to, well, in practical compilers, there's a lot of optimization done on that level based on particular heuristics. Practical compilers will rarely only try to implement every switch with just the switch table approach, but they might alternate between switch tables and if then else cascades, depending on the actual layout of values that you have provided for the cases. And they might even switch between the table-based approach and the if-then-else approach based on particular regions of case values that you have provided. So there might be arbitrarily difficult constructs coming out of there, and that's quite quite a challenge to try to decipher that later on. But for our purposes, we have seen the basic idea behind how the table-based index approach works, and you can, I think, easily figure out how to come up with an implementation with an if-then-else chain.
In the case of having holes in your switch state, it wouldn't be the easiest way to have, you know, find like the blocks that are continuous and then always put the rest in the default case of that one.
Yeah, you. That could be, yeah. But you can be arbitrarily creative in this kind of thing. But that's, for example, one way of working that out. It also depends a little bit on the actual values which you have in there. So if you have, for example, a few cases in the lower digits, like 3, 5, 7, and then continue with 14,400 and everything else, you have these large spaces of values that are covered in there, which just are not good idea to implement. So you can imagine you do these clusters of very dense, densely covered cases, and branch to these clusters based on if-then-else, for example, and recurse that by need in that sense. Yeah, well, you can put a lot of work in there, and it's not a there is no easy best solution out there, so there's a lot of heuristics that you can apply there and a lot of work that you can put into optimizing this kind of code. And it's actually not so easy to say what the optimal code looks like if you think of cache behaviors and actual timings of comparisons and all that, so that's quite a hard job to come up with an optimal solution there. So another thing that you might wonder or have wondered already was this address environment row that we have introduced in order to deal with variables. And the most intriguing thing about that is how to come up with the actual storage allocation for variables. How do we figure out where to place them on the virtual machine? So what we need is to be able to statically, which means at compile time, figure out a constant to be used as a fixed address for a particular variable. It's usually meant to be a relative address or an absolute address, depending on the context of the variable. You learn more about that in the actual compiler construction thing, where we deal with these global and local variables. So what we have also here is that for our fragment of C, we restrict ourselves to the basic types occupying just one particular storage cell. We don't deal with longs, short, byte, whatever. Everything is for us just an int and occupies one cell in that sense. What we also assumes that we allocate the variables in the store in the order in which they are declarated, and start with address 1 in that sense, being for the local variables it's a relative address of 1 in relation to the frame beginning, and we stack them up in the order in which we find them allocated. So, if we find now a declaration sequence like the one over here, this variables x1 to xk, then the address environment row can be easily thought of as just returning the index of the actual variable. So for this variable x1, it gives relative address 1, xi is I, and xk is xk. So it just is the enumeration of these things. So this is not all too difficult, but given that you can obtain the declarations, depending on the C standard in which you find yourself writing, or for which you find yourself writing a compiler, you might even have helping constraints like NCC having all the declarations in the beginning of a block. This makes it very easy for you to actually come up with the address environment for that. If it's more difficult, then you might need the help of semantic analysis from the compiler, which will give you the right address environment. But for our purposes, I think they will be mostly given in there, unless we say differently. So basic types is easy for us. This is just aligning them next to each other with a distance of 1 in memory. So if we now are interested in more complicated stuff like arrays, this is now not so easy anymore. Consider the example where variable A is declared as an array. The thing is that A now can be accessed in an indexed way, and each of the given indices from 0 to 10 will evaluate to a different value. So we, in order to store that, we actually need more space than just one cell on our store. Instead, we need 11 components. So usually we would like to arrange them next to each other in memory, starting from A0 to A10. And, well, for our purposes here, the address environment would give the same value for the address of A, so the beginning address of the array, and the address of A's zeroth cell. So in order to now come up with with the actual indices for each of these things, as for each of the variables in the address environment, we now need some way to talk about the actual size that particular variables might have. So far, in the examples before, we have always assumed that we just deal with basic data types. For basic data types, we said that, of course, there's these hierarchies, but we just don't deal with them. We just say that every basic data type has, for our purposes, a size of 1. Our size of operation that we do will just return 1 for a basic type. However, if we have T being an array type, we in an array of the subtype T prime, our size of function will consist of the size of dispatched to our subtype T prime times the cells that the array actually has. So for this example of int 11a, it would be 11 times the size of an integer, which is basic type, so it's 1, so the size of the whole thing would be 11. So if we have a declaration sequence like the one over here, we would start with, well, the address for the first element being 1, and addresses for variables I would be computable as the addresses of the previous variable added with a value of the type of the previous variable. So if we start declaring a few integer variables, we will just always get a direct successor to the initial address, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, for example. If we then have a an array type, we would still give it the address with just increment of 1, so address 6, but the then following thing would need to leave space for the rest of the array. So the next address for, let it be another integer, would continue at previous address plus the size of the array. Okay, since the actual types of the variables are things that you can obtain at compile time, also see the compiler construction lecture. You can just call some API methods or just retrieve the actual types from some data structures in your annotated syntax tree, and with that you can easily evaluate this this size of operator at compile time, because you can just access the actual types and just decide what these things should be. And also, I think, in at least for our purposes, the number of cells that such an array has is always meant to be a constant, so this will always be compile time evaluable, and with that we can just come up with fixed relative addresses for these things. So now that we have talked about the allocation of memory for not only basic types but also arrays, we might be also interested in actually using arrays in some meaningful way in our expressions. So we would like to somehow extend the expression evaluation to deal also with array elements. And for that purpose, well, we first might need to decide whether an array, an indexed array expression, is valid as a left-hand side. Is it? Well, why not? We would at some point also want to write into array cells. So what we need is not only provide the evaluation of the content of an array, but also provide an address operator for, or address cogeneration for an array expression. So let's have a look at how that can be achieved. We emanate from from A being declared as an array of type T and size of C. So, the start address of a component, how could we do that? Well, it's listed over there. If it's defined in the way over here, we always have to start with the base address of the array, which is given by address of A, and then remember we have following the initial cell, we have all the following cells. So depending on the actual index, we need to come up with the value for the index, which is given by R value cogeneration, and multiply it with the base size of the array, which is left variable here. In case of an integer array, this would always be 1, but we might have arbitrary arrays later on, so let's not restrict us to just integers. So, as a consequence, in order to compute the address of an array cell, we have, first of all, we need the the base address of the array, which we can get with the load C, so computing the constant for the loading the constant for the base address of A. Then we need to compute the value of the index expression, which is a code R over here. And we then need to multiply with the size of the type, which is done with the load C of T type of, and that is a compile time known value which we can compute at compile time and have to fill in. Then we do the actual multiplication and add that to the base address. In a more general way, well, you might ask whether you would also always assume this A to be an actual real variable name, but you might also think of the first part of this array expression to be somehow computed in some way, maybe from a from some computation. So you would probably go over to the more general code generation form that you see over here, where we have the base address given by some expression 1 and the index value from some expression 2. And you need to multiply with the base type size, like multiply and then add. So this E1 might be some kind of pointer obtained through some magical way for now. And this is in C considered to be kind of similar as to the base address of an array. So you can use that in an exchangeable way in that sense. And also you notice that in the in C, for example, you are quite flexible in the way that you specify your array accesses. So all those things here are in that sense somehow equivalent to each other, and that is reflected also in the translation scheme that you see over here. If you toy around with these examples, and you will notice that this will automatically work due to the way how this load C adapts to the actual type of what you have as expressions there. So this will still work in that sense. However, for our purposes later on, we will just emanate from the idea that the pointer part or the naming part of the array will occur in front and the index in the brackets. So of course this would still work other way, but it's quite messy to read, so yeah, does not necessarily need to be like that. Also, of course, we might be interested in not only the address of a thing, but also the value of the array cell, and we can kind of canonically just extend the code generation scheme from the L value code generation to the R value code generation, and for just the array base value, the R value is the same as the L value. So we can then continue with structures, records, or whatever you would like to call them. So this is composite data types for us. So the approach would be that during the type analysis, a semantic analysis provided by the compiler once again, we would already have taken care of structures in the sense that for each structure type, we would already have a particular address environment specific to that particular type only. So a structure struct st, for example, would lead the compiler to provide a particular named address environment row st for struct st, or row a for struct a, or whatever you would have there, which would provide particular information for the location of each of the struct's elements relative to the start address of such a struct instance. So in our example, we would be given an address environment of the form that you see over here. So there's this row st for struct st with the relative index 0 for the first component and the relative address 1 for the second component, being created by, well, the base address of the relative address of the first thing summed up with its size. So it's again the same scheme as you have seen for the general address environment creation. You always take your predecessor's address and add your predecessor's size to obtain your own address. And that's the way how structures work in that sense. So, yeah, so this is what you see given in this formula, where the first relative address is just zero. It starts right at the beginning of the structure. There's no need for any other management data fields in there. And you compute your ith component address by the address of component I minus 1 added to the size of the type of the predecessor. So in order to now come up with code generation for struct accesses, what we can now do is think of how to generate code that gives us addresses of the elements of a struct, and this will essentially what you need is the base address of the actual struct added to the relative address of the element that you want to access. You get the element that you want to access as a name out of the syntax tree. So this dot C here is the access operator, and the C is the actual textual name of the component that you want to access. You can look that up in the address environment for the structure, or for the structure type of the expression from before. So all you need to do is come up with a base address for the struct. You get that by calling to the LHS value code generation for the basis expression. And then all you need to do is add the as an offset the relative address depending on the address environment of this of ease type. So this lookup here will look up the name C in the address environment belonging to T, which is the type for E. This is a compile time thing. You can you have this information available from the compiler. It has created that for you, so you can just fill in the number that you get from here in this instruction load C. So you have an actual number, you have the evaluated base address of the thing, so all you do now is add, and you get the code L for the array for the struct access. And this all works given that E has type T, of course. Good. So in an example, let's emanate from the case that we have struct st with the with the cells for A and B, and the address environment, the general address environment, giving us 13 as the address for X. So in order to translate x.b with respect to its address, what we do is we load the base address from X, which we obtain from the generic row, or not the generic, the general row, which will give us load C13. Then we need to load the relative address out of the address environment for the struct st. We access b, which is finds itself being the second element. Thus, it is the start address of its predecessor, which is 0, plus the size of its predecessors, which is 1. So it finds itself resting at 1. And this is the value that we will insert for the load C over here. And all we need to do now is add up things. So that's it, I think. Before we start to dive into pointers and dynamic storage management, I think it's already almost 11:45, so that's a good thing to do next time. So that would be all from my side for today. Thank you for your attention, and have a nice tutorial on Thursday.